Well, welcome to Pop-Up Stories, which is a production of Current State from WKAR Radio, which comes your way three times every weekday on 90.5 FM and AM 870, our interview program and live music program, and ARCA at Michigan State University, the Residential College of Arts and Humanities, have also helped us put this together here today, and it's a first. It's the first time that we have done this. We have two more similar events planned that we'll tell you about here momentarily. But tying in with the theme of the Allen Marketplace here today, we decided to make it all about food. So as you probably already know, the theme is hungry and fed. So we've encouraged storytellers and people who enjoy hearing stories about food or being hungry or being fed to join us here today. We want to thank everybody who signed on to plan to join us. And if you're just wandering by and you're overcome by the storytelling impulse, and it involves being hungry or being fed, get with us up here, and we'd be happy to turn the microphone over here to you. So I'll remind everybody that we have similar events planned for October the 11th. That's a Sunday, I believe. Sunday the 11th, 2 p.m. The theme is Loan and Borrow at the East Lansing Public Library. And coming up on the 21st of October, my brain doesn't work fast enough to figure out what day that is, but it's the 21st of October. Create and Destroy is the theme at the Reach Studio Art Center in Rio Town. So if you come up with a great story along those lines, keep us in mind. We are going to invite our first storyteller here to the microphone, Bob Pena. Why don't you make your way on up here? Is your story more about being hungry or being fed, Bob?
Being fed.
Okay, very good. Bob Pena.
Well, the story's short. It takes place, in the summer of 2014. And it happens that my brother-in-law and my sister-in-law are both, work till very late in the evening. So very commonly I have my niece, Isla, with me, usually till 8 o'clock or so. And we often do, chalk on the sidewalk. We draw Hello Kitty, flowers, animals, stick figures of the family. But invariably, somebody will walk by on the sidewalk, and they will ask about our chickens. We have chickens in the yard, and they say, "Ooh, do you have those for meat, or do you have those for eggs, or why do you have these chickens?" And invariably, we'll say, "Well, they're pets, but kind of pets with benefits. We get eggs out of them. Call them our dessert chickens. We commonly use the eggs for things like chocolate chip cookies, brownies, that kind of thing, puddings. Anyhow, so somebody came by when Isla and I were drawing on the sidewalk with chalk one evening, and they stopped and they asked, "Well, if they're really pets, what are their names?" I said, "Well, I defer to my little niece, Isla." And Isla said, Zachary, or she would say Steve, or Gavin, or she would say something like Emery, all little boys' names, right? So the people would invariably walk on, and I would say, "Hey, Isla, why are you naming these chickens, which are supposed to be feminine, with boys' names?" And she'd say, "Well, just because I want to." And there comes a point when you think about life and you say, "Well, is it so important to be right or to do right?" And sometimes you just let these things go. So somewhere later in that summer, a year ago, in the middle of summer, somebody came by, like they always do, walking their dog. And they said, "Hey, somebody I didn't know, how come you have these chickens here?" And I said, "Well, they're for eggs, and they're for family use, and they're for, just to love on. I come home from work, and they run to the fence, and they tug on my pants, and they just want to be picked up. So in some regards, they're just like puppies." But this time was a little different. And Isla said, when I deferred to her to say, "Well, what are your pets' names?" Isla said, "Anna and Elsa." And I was kind of taken aback a little bit. I said, "Whoa, those are feminine names. And then I know where they came from, too." So for those of you that don't know, there's a Disney kind of series going on now with Hans Christian Andersen's story of two princesses in the North, and one is named Anna, and one is named Elsa. And anyhow, yeah, okay. And so I said, "Wow, that's kind of nice." But I thought that would change. But no, that anchored. There's something when a person takes voice for themselves and they say things for themselves and they claim something. So I let her claim it. You know, what else? Why not? So the summer went on and the fall came, and it came to be to the point where it was getting colder, and I would tease her a little bit, and I said, you know, winter's coming. And she said, yes, I know. And said, you know, when the winter comes and these little chickens lay eggs, these eggs will be frozen. So anyhow, the winter came and the chicks were warm and cozy in their little shed, and they laid an egg every day, and they still are laying. But this year, Isla has started kindergarten, and we're very proud of her. She's been 2 days in school now, and it was kind of it's fun to have these chickens. There's a little gal that comes around from around the corner. Her name is Gertrude, and she has a little toy poodle, and she walks by, and sometimes she'll say, "Hey, Bob, how are you doing with those chickens?" And she's really fishing for a few eggs. So I'll run inside the house, and I'll take a carton, and I feel like Solomon, and I'll take that egg carton and cut it in half. I said, "Now come outside." I said, "Gertrude, I have a six-pack for you." And she walks away with her little six eggs and a gleam in her eye. And so, you know, I think of how these chickens have not only fed us, I guess, with the material eggs that we eat, but they've fed some of us with personal conviction and ownership of self. And they've even fed an old 51-year-old guy with the ability to just say, okay, sometimes it's fine to let things go. So here's to two little chickens named Anna and Elsa, who fed us in many, many levels.
We got some freebies for you here, Bob. All right. Thank you, Bob. You got us started. This is our first pop-up stories event, and you were our first storyteller, and we've picked up a few just from the crowd. Yeah. Nice work, Bob. Keep in mind that another option here, if you've got a story inside you and it just doesn't feel right to stand up to the microphone and tell it, that you can... quite a few people have left little miniature versions of stories on our little poster over here with post-it notes. So again, the theme is hungry and fed. So if you have a story, even a very short story involving being hungry and fed. In fact, here are a couple of them. In fact, the cue here for the post-it notes is the most memorable meal I ever had. Thanksgiving at my grandma's, turkey, gravy, stuffing, and drunk relatives. And Chinese food ordered into a new house. Who hasn't been through that? They've moved to a new house and there's nothing in the house but a candle, and you call out for pizza and you eat pizza by candlelight on the living room floor in your new apartment or your new house. Chinese food ordered to a new house. We had no furniture, just takeout and candles. Perfect. The most memorable meal I ever had here on the poster back here. So we are ready for our next storyteller. We want to welcome Vincent Delgado to the microphone. A lot of you know Vincent.
All right.
Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you so much. I've been thinking about what story to tell, and so I decided to tell in one that's very old school. So this goes way back to 2001, so way back. This story is a short story with a long setup. And in 2001, I was the new director, and I think at that point the interim vice president for refugee services. So I had gone from being a 27-year-old reporter at the Lansing State Journal in 2 years to running a resettlement agency with a $10 million budget. And this was about 2 months after September 11th. And it was at that point that I realized I was really unqualified for this work. I did not know what I was doing. And the reason I found that out was some things happened in rapid succession at that time that proved to me that I didn't know what I was doing. And what I guess how this connects to Hungry and Fed is it certainly has to do with refugees who are come to our communities hungry for new lives. And it also has to do with a certain kind of hunger that people here on the East Side and people that work in our community have for change, for exciting experiences, and oftentimes because of that find themselves in positions for which they are highly unqualified for. And so what happened then was certainly we had September 11th occur. That summer was the resettlement of these lost boys for Sudan, from Sudan, and I had, and I don't know what intelligence, had decided to take two foster boys at the age of 28, so I was exactly about 10 years older than them, and found out that I was unqualified for parenting 18-year-olds at that point. So that was the summer, and then September 11th hit, and we had to resettle 80 families from Afghanistan from September 11th to October 1st. And the reason was is because that was the end of the federal fiscal year, and we had to move Afghan families out of harm's way in refugee camps in Pakistan. So that was a busy time. I was exhausted. I was sleeping at the agency most of the days, trying to move people and making lots of mistakes. Sometimes families would show up and there'd be three beds for a couple, and then other families of 10 would show up and there'd be four beds for 10, and we were always moving stuff around, trying to make sure people were taken care of. In the middle of that, a couple of other things happened that showed that I really didn't know what I was doing and how I was what I was involved in. One was I met a man who was the son of the Santeria high priest in Miami. He was a Cuban refugee, and he was his son. And this happened 2 weeks before this story occurred, and I think I was still hungover from that experience. He decided that he would read me my future, which in Santeria involves drinking a lot of rum and spraying it on bones and moving them around. And he told me I was going to have two children and a cat who was going to die from an unknown disease. So the truth is, I have two children now and wasn't supposed to, so there was some truth to that. But there was also a cat involved. And I had this cat who immediately after that experience I took to the vet to say, what's wrong with this cat? And the vet said, well, what's wrong with your cat? Is there any sickness, any symptoms? I said, no. And that's when I realized I couldn't tell him that a Santeria priest had told me that this cat was sick and was going to die, and there was no way we knew what it was. So I just took him home. The cat has since died of an unknown disease, so that happened. Hopefully not because of my incompetence. But the next week, another experience occurred, and this had to do with an Afghan resettlement experience, where we were told that, and this is, I'm coming up to the story here. We were told that a family needed to get out of Russia. And my policy at the time was I would never say no to any human rights organization that needed to move someone to Lansing. So my answer was always yes. So this particular family had 10 people in it. And they said that the patriarch of the family was sick. That's all we knew. And I said, great, send them to Lansing. And I knew I had to find a house with 10 beds, and I thought that was going to be a big job, which it was. But I was very proud. We had found that house with 10 beds. And we went to pick them up at the airport, and this man got off first. It was a Russian doctor, and gave me this form and said, sign it. And I said, well, what's on the form? And he said, well, it's in Russian, and you can't read it, but sign it. And I said, well, what does it say? And he said, it means you're going to take them no matter what. And I hadn't seen this person. I thought, okay, I am incompetent, but I'm going to do this. So I signed the form. The Russian doctor literally turned around and got back on the plane, and the family got off. And it turns out that this gentleman was quadriplegic. So he wasn't just sick. He had no use for his arms and his legs. And I, of course, in my wisdom, had found in a three-bedroom apartment on a second story, walk-up. So we had to go crazy trying to move everything. And there had been all sorts of mishaps during that time. The media was very interested in my work. And someone had informed me about that time that if you misspend federal money, you can go to jail. I didn't know that until that point when I was running the refugee services. And I became very worried about it all the time. I was obsessed with the money. Who's spending money on what? Because I am not going to go to jail over all this. I'm not even qualified. I told them I wasn't qualified. So finally, the next day, we found a new apartment. We got them all set. I felt great. I'm not going to go to jail. I'm not going to be in the media. Everything's going to work out great. When one of my assistants came up to me and said, Vincent, I've got some news for you. I said, what is it? And they said, the clients that just arrived from Russia say they lost their bag of gold. Bag of gold? Wait a second. What do you mean bag of gold? Why do they have a bag of gold? And I thought, for sure, I'm being set up. Police are going to get called. I'm going to jail for sure. And I said, well, find it. And they looked for a long time. And no good. No bag of gold. And I said, well, this is just a setup. They're trying, somebody's trying to get a bag of gold out of me. And I don't have one, and I'm not going to jail. And so I said, I'm going to go down and look in the van that had transported them. And sure enough, I put my hands into the seat cushions, and I felt this velvety, just like you would think, satchel. Pulled it out. I looked in, because I'd never seen a bag of gold before. And I looked in, and sure enough, there was a bag of gold just sitting in the seats. I don't know what it was worth, but it turns out refugees often have to travel with alternative currency, which is what I learned later. But the reason I like that story, and I think about it often, is that people come to this community with bags of gold all the time, and we don't notice it. We don't notice that the person that maybe on the face of it is highly unqualified, but actually could be qualified for doing lots of great things for our community. And we bring people into our community, and there's people around us right now holding bags of gold. We just have to stick our hands in the seat cushions and find them. Thank you.
Thank you, Vincent. By the way, Mr. Scorey is providing a musical cue at 4 minutes. So the idea is 5-minute stories. So that's exactly. That's what you hear at 5 minutes. We're nice at 4 minutes. That's what you hear at five. The most memorable meal I ever had. This is on our board out here, by the way. If you're not in the mood to come to the microphone and actually tell a story, here's a little opportunity to get a little story out of your system. The most memorable meal I ever had, relearning to cook halal lamb instead of Easter ham when I invited a Muslim friend to join our family celebration. Well done. It is Pop-Up Stories, courtesy of Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Also, the Residential College of Arts and Humanities has played a key role here in this, which is our first of three pop-up storytelling events. We will tell you more about the other ones coming up here in just a little bit. Right now, Anita Skeen is next up. Our theme is Hungry and Fed. Hi, Anita.
How's that? Is that okay? I wore my T-shirt specifically for this occasion. Can you see it? But it's too cold. So I'm going to. Oh, it says the purple onion, fresh fruit and vegetables, Charleston, West Virginia. And on the back it says not your average grocery store or something like that. So I grew up in a part of the country where people seem to think storytellers are bread in the bone, that people from the mountains sit around on their porch and tell the stories from generations back again and again and again. But I did not grow up in that kind of a storytelling culture. My grandfathers were preachers. One was a Baptist preacher, the other was in the Church of God. So the stories that filtered down to me as a child were Bible stories. And rarely were stories told in my house that were not connected to the Bible. So when Dean Steve asked me to do this this evening, I thought, what on earth am I going to talk about? I'm not a storyteller. I don't know how to tell stories. And I heard this little voice in the back of my head, which I have come to recognize as my mother, who has been deceased for 8 years, but does not stop talking to me. But she said, well, tell them about the miracle of the loaves and the fishes. And I said, Mother, I'm not going to tell them about the loaves and the fishes. And she said, tell them about the loaves and the fishes. Tell them about the feeding of the 5,000. You're supposed to be talking about being hungry and being fed. What better story could you tell them? I'm not telling them that story, Mother. And so I am not telling you that story. And if you want to know, go look in Matthew. Actually, go look in all four of the Gospels and you'll find it. But it made me start to think about miracles related to food and what personal miracle I might have related to food. So I got to thinking about the miracle of canning. And when I was a child, there was a lot of canning that went on in my mother's kitchen while my grandmother was living with us. My grandmother passed away when I was 14. But up until that time, about this time or a little earlier in August every summer, this battered old red station wagon would pull up in front of our house. The doors would open, and out would spill my Uncle Herb, my Aunt Marie, my four girl cousins in bushel baskets of tomatoes, beans, peaches, suitcases, all of the things my uncle had gotten a deal on. And so my uncle would say, Marie, get the bags. And the kids and my Aunt Marie would haul up our very steep driveway all of these bushel baskets of, I mean, I can see peaches rolling down the driveway as they're hauling these up while he went up to sit on the couch and watch television. But very shortly after that happened, my mother and my grandmother and my Aunt Marie would get out the aprons, get out the spoons, get out the pots and pans and the pressure cooker, and pretty soon things would start happening in the kitchen. Now, the job of all the girls was to sit on the back porch and snap the beans. I'm not sure they trusted us with knives because we never cut tomatoes and we never cut peaches. We snapped the beans, half runner beans, break them in half, peel the strings, break them in half, break them in half, put the four pieces in a basket, go on to the next bean. This takes a long time. And I'm not sure what we talked about, the cousins, while we sat on the back stoop and snapped the beans, but I'm sure it wasn't food. And so beans might happen one day. The next day, you would know it was tomatoes, because if any of you have been around someone canning tomatoes, it just settles on the house. Red. And you can't breathe. And years later, when I was in graduate school in Bowling Green, Ohio, I lived near the Heinz factory, which made ketchup in the summer, and that all came back. One day there would be peaches. And as I was a kid and I never really thought about how the canning would feed us in the winter, when I put those jars, those mason jars in the garage, took them out of the kitchen and put them away, and even when I went to get them, I think, in the winter, I enjoyed the peaches, the sweetness, but I didn't think about the sweetness of the moment. And I didn't think that someday I would want to look back on that time. So for me, the miracle that has to do with that food is the miracle of memory. And that I can look back when I eat peaches and beans and tomatoes now, and I can look back to that time, and when I am hungry for those childhood experiences, I can be fed. And I brought a little show-and-tell item here. This will take 1 minute. Years later, I went to the house that my grandmother grew up in, which was in much disarray. And from the rubble over away from the house, I unearthed this jar. I have no evidence that this is a jar that my grandmother might have canned with her mother 100 years ago, but maybe it is. So I have this jar sitting on a shelf on my bookcase in my study. And when I look over at this jar, and when I'm, I would say, hungry for those lost times in the past, even though this jar is empty, I can be fed. Thank you.
Thanks, Anita. We're a little ahead of schedule here. We're going to have Mr. Scorey play a song or two here for us, and we'll be right back with Matt Jason, our pop-up stories event, Hungry and Fed. Stay where you are. Scorey. That's a Janis Joplin song, Cosmic Blues. Thanks for being here this evening. It's Pop-Up Stories from Current State, WKAR, and the Residential College of Arts and Humanities at MSU. Matt Jason is our next storyteller. The theme is Hungry and Fed. Matt?
Thanks, Mark. I appreciate it. Well, we're doing pop-up stories in a facility where I opened up a pop-up brewery with my partner, Jeremy Sprague, But the first thing I thought of wasn't necessarily beer or our business, but I thought of agriculture. So I teach world history, and the very first thing I thought of was when I have my students come in, my freshmen that I teach, as I point out the window at Eastern High School, and I say, look at this building out there. You see those bricks? We wouldn't have those bricks without people growing food for the brick makers. You wouldn't have those devices in your pockets without people growing the food that there's a surplus of that the people making, you know, the phones can live off of. And so feeding ourselves both nutritionally and spiritually or emotionally, you know, has been important for a long time. And so civilization as we know it, with all these different jobs, we've got folks who are working in radio, selling beer, wouldn't be possible without this change that we made 10,000 years ago when we went from hunter-gatherers to farmers. And I think what's happened is that people were fed then, and we were fed physically, and civilizations grew, and now we've fed so many that it's in some ways we have problems, right? We have, in this country in particular, we have lots of people who are fed but are unhealthy. And I think that this emotional or spiritual hunger is still very much a part of the human experience. And so for me, I remember wanting to be the teacher. I watched Head of the Class. You guys remember the show? And I wanted to be the ponytailed white dude who's in front of this diverse group of kids in New York. And I grew up in this suburban community in Grand Rapids, and I ran away from that. And because I wanted to live with all kinds of people that excited me and opened me up to the rest of the world. And I did that, and it kept feeding me. And it kept feeding me. So that hunger to strive for that. At the same time, the educational world changed. And I also realized I wanted to do things with my hands. And I couldn't let this dream, this hunger of opening my own business, go away. And luckily, or maybe not for him, I wrote my good friend Jeremy Sprague into this. And, you know, as I went on this journey, became a teacher, experienced that, I realized I've got to work in the 15, 20 years, and I'd like to try something different. So I was fed, right? I had a house, car, like healthy kids. But, yeah, I kept finding myself wanting to take this risk. And people would say, you know, why do you want to do this? You know, you've got a great career. You've got health insurance, right? I don't know how many times I've heard that from people. But, yeah, I had this hunger to say, I'm going to take this risk and do this. And so I think that's a part of the human experience. It's a part of, you know, who we are, and it goes way back before asphalt and cars and before the wheel. You know, people have been on this earth for over 100,000 years, and I think, you know, people have always had to take risks, and I think that we're wired to do that. And so for me, having this pop-up brewery here at this wonderful facility at the Allen Marketplace, it's allowed Jeremy and I to start taking this risk and figure this out. So we had this hunger. We kept going. We kept finding out, can we do this? We took business classes. We took brewing classes. And every step of the way, we wanted to hear no. Like, no, just go back to this safe thing. But yet, along the way, it just made more and more sense. And that hunger, I realized, as we opened here and we started serving people our products, and then we had people come to us, like Penny Tomac here has wonderful pumpkins. And she's like, well, can you make beer with these? And so we're like, well, yeah, I think we can. And from Urbandale Farm, we started getting lavender. And so the hunger that we had to start something here and to do something different and to bring something special to Lansing, I know that sounds kind of like cheesy to say, oh, it's a brewery, but we wanted to make it a Lansing-made thing. And as we've gotten these products from people around us, that's feeding us, right, this desire, this emotional desire to, I think, satisfy our urge, we're just hungrier now. And so we're opening up a spot right on the other side now around the corner, and we're excited to see where it goes. So I think, you know, inextricably like life and death, this being hungry and being fed, they go with each other, because you wake up the next day and you're hungry again. So, I think we have to remember, as humans, where we come from, and tap into those roots and follow that hunger. So, thank you.
Thanks, Matt. Keep in mind that you can also share your hungry and fed stories, hunger and fed stories, in two other ways besides coming up at the microphone here. You can leave it on the banner behind you with a post-it note. Again, our theme is hungry and fed. Or you can send it. You can blast it out to the Twitterverse with the hashtag pop-up stories. Hashtag pop-up stories. One of the little hungry and fed stories from the board here, the most memorable meal I ever had. That's what we're asking you to finish. The most memorable meal I ever had. The kebabs I ate after running away from the Turkish police. Top that. Michigan Pops is giving popsicles to all of the storytellers, too. So do they go inside for that, I take it?
I got a coupon in their bag.
There's a coupon in your bag. Okay. Sarah Mack has a story for us now, our youngest storyteller, if she's here. We're going to have to lower the microphone for Sarah.
So my story of how I was hungry and I was fed was when I moved up north and I didn't have many friends. And I came home from a Halloween party. And I walked into my house, and my mom was waiting in the living room for me, and she was carving a pumpkin, saying, like, how did you pick such a big pumpkin? I can't even carve it. And then I walked towards her, and the pumpkin starts moving, and a baby beagle pops out. And then I start to smell some pumpkin seeds, like, cooking. And I asked my mom if she was making them. And she said, yeah, because she knows they're my favorite. And so I was fed because I was eating the pumpkin seeds next to my new best friend, who I fed her spirit and she fed mine, because I was missing out on a new best friend. And now she is always so hungry, and I always feed her, and she feeds my spirit every day because she's just so darn cute. And she is turning 4 this August. Well, this September, around the 31st. And we celebrate it on Halloween.
The most memorable meal I ever had. More stories from the poster board. When I was little, I got on the table and ate 3 whole sticks of butter. I'm a vegetarian now, it says. Most memorable meal I ever had, canned sardines with raspberry jam on rye bread at summer camp. That is a meal made for summer camp right there. Pop-up stories, hungry and fed, is our theme from WKAR's Current State and from the Residential College of Arts and Humanities at Michigan State University. Thank you for being here. Karen Blackman is next on our list. Karen?
All right, you can tell I'm an amateur because I have some notes. But so I'm Karen Blackman, and I am from the Upper Peninsula, and I was raised in the 50s and the 60s. And I, from my perch in the Upper Peninsula, watched on TV the footage from the Civil Rights Movement. I was very moved by that. Come closer. Okay, it just feels too high. Okay, so that's the setup. This story takes place in 1967, I went to the University of Michigan to go to college, and after my sophomore year of college, I went to Washington, D.C. I followed a boyfriend there and got a job at a place, I don't know if any of you ever heard of it, Hogate Seafood Restaurant. So Hogate Seafood Restaurant was sprawling, enormous seafood, iconic restaurant in Washington, D.C. on the southwest side. It served 3,000 meals a day. It had places for 600 people to sit. There was a huge staff, as you might imagine. There was a wait staff, and there was a kitchen staff. And they had career people who worked there on the wait staff, but I was hired because they were hiring up for the summer. So I got a job. I was very unfamiliar with urban life. They fed the staff in the basement between the two shifts. We worked the lunch shift and the supper shift, and they fed us at a large cafeteria in the basement with a cafeteria line and two dining rooms. It started out to be a very lonely summer for me. The older waitresses weren't very friendly to me. It was quite an urban journey for me to get to work. One young waitress was also hired for the summer, and she was quite friendly, but she didn't live far away, so she would go during the in-between the lunch and supper shift. She sometimes would go off back home. But a few times we hung out together, and one day she confided a secret in me. She told me, "I am passing for white." And I was, I didn't know anything about that. And she said that if she had told people that she was black, that she was actually a light-skinned black person, but if she told people that she would not be hired as a waitress. That was not allowed. And so meanwhile, my friendships kind of grew with the people in the kitchen. The black people who worked in the kitchen tended to be younger and were very friendly to me when I came into the kitchen to get my food. They always made, you know, various individuals who I became friends with made sure I got my food for my customers, and they were very friendly, and we had more in common. We were younger, and they would kind of joke around with me. So one day I was in the cafeteria between the shifts, and I was talking with Jeannie from the kitchen, and she was ahead of me in this cafeteria line in the basement. We both had full trays of food. We were being served in the cafeteria line by this very large sort of red-haired, burly guy who would cook the food and serve it to the staff. And I am talking to Jeannie. We're in mid-conversation. And I have a tray full of food, and I follow her into the dining room where she's going to eat, the dining room on the right. And suddenly this man, this big fellow who served the food, is in that dining room. He picks me up with tray of food and all. He throws me out of the dining room into the central area where the cafeteria line was. I fall on the floor. The food goes absolutely everywhere. And I am so embarrassed. I'm just angry, humiliated. No one seems to help me. I don't remember anyone helping me. I don't remember if I ate or not, or who cleaned up the food. I have almost no memory of the incident beyond that, except that I suddenly got it. Like, the black people who were eating in the right dining room, the kitchen staff, were eating there not just because they knew and liked each other. And the white people from the wait staff were not just eating in the left-hand dining room because they knew and liked each other, but because it was segregated. And it had not really been clear to me until that moment. So that's almost the end of the story. I went home that night to this apartment I was staying at. I called my sister Jill, who was at that time a new teacher in the Washington, D.C. area. She was dating a fellow whose brother happened to be in the FBI. the FBI called me up and did some investigation, and very promptly, within the next few weeks, starting before I left and went back to University of Michigan, the federal government desegregated Hogate Seafood Restaurant. So I have many thoughts over the years about this incident, some truly chastising myself about why I was so dense. But I recently had a charitable thought, which was that I've been thinking, because I work at MSU now, which I didn't until I was somewhat older, how young people like those I meet at MSU with a different paradigm than their parents sometimes make, even by accident, a difference in the world just by having that worldview that doesn't assume the old one. And then at those times, I think maybe that was a good thing about my naive, clueless, yet good-willed self.
Mike Scorey, our musician here tonight. Another round of applause for Mike. Thanks, Mike. Mike's going to be on Current State, as it turns out. We are putting this together as we speak a week from Friday, every Friday at 9 o'clock when we do our show live. We always play live music. So Mike's the guy. He's going to be playing at the Old Town Jazz Fest, Old Town Blues Fest, I beg your pardon, Old Town Blues Fest, but he'll be on the show that day. So thank you, Mike. Pop-up stories from Current State and from the Residential College of Arts and Humanities. Is it Deidrea? Deidre? Deidre Humphreys is next. Our theme is Hungry and Fed. Welcome, Deidre.
Hi. My name is Deidre Humphreys, and I am a member of the Anahata Dragon Boat team here in Lansing. And the story I want to tell you is about being hungry for gold. I have a little cheat sheet, but I also use it as a prop. So a couple of weeks ago, we went to race at Lake Orion. It's a festival called Dragon in the Lake, Dragon on the Lake in northern Oakland County. And we had been to this race two years before and gotten third in this race. And so as we went into our winter training last year, it was all about getting our mindset that we were going to win first place at Lake Orion. And so all the time that we're lifting weights and punching the bag, we're thinking about gold. And my red-haired Russian teammate, Alona, all she could say was, "Next time we will crush them." So this is the mindset. Now, I don't tend to think that way. I just try to take things as they come. So we land in Lake Orion in the athletes' camp on August the 30th, and we're getting ready for our race. There are two qualifying heats and the final. So I look on the roster, and the coach has put the roster together for all three races, and he's got me paddling on the right. Now, the way that you paddle in a dragon boat, you only paddle one side. So on the right, this would be the right, means that my left hand would be up and my right hand is on the bottom. So if this is, you know, the top, it's like this, and you drag the paddle back through the water. Well, I'm right-handed, so my right side is stronger than my left side. But in order to paddle, I got to turn like this. So this is my weak side. I'm not all that happy about it, but I don't say anything because I'm a good crew member. So we go out in the boat and paddle up to the line. And what they call is paddlers, are you ready? And that's when you put your paddle in and you listen for the horn. And we paddle, and I cannot keep a hold to this paddle. It is so fast out there. And I'm struggling, really, seriously. I'm struggling with this paddle. So we finish the race, and we go back, and we get in our huddle with Rob, and he asks, how's it going, and how did it go, and I do like this. And he looks at me, and he says, why did you pull your paddle? And that means I took my paddle out, and I'm like, I didn't mean to. I lost control of the paddle, but I am so mortified that my coach hollered at me in front of everybody else. And even more mortified because we won the race without me. Without, you know, that's a terrible feeling when you're not on a, when you're on a team and you don't feel like you're contributing, right? So we get 2 hours between races. So the whole time for the 2 hours, I'm practicing the stroke. You know, I gotta get this because I'm on the right side for the second heat as well. So. I'm practicing. People come over and help me, and the coach does, you know. And I say to Rob, I say, you know, I just don't want to be the weak sister on the team. And he says, well, you're not, so, you know, just keep paddling. So we go back out, and on the way, I get some of this wax that you can put on the paddle, and it helps your hand grip better, sort of like a super glue. So I can keep my hands on the paddle and keep my paddle in the water. And we run the race, and I keep in sync with my teammates because that's how you get the boat to go fast. And we finish the race, and we win that heat as well. So we did it in, it's 300 meters, and we did the first race in 1:20, and that second race we did in 1:19. So we're getting better. We cut a whole second, and that's huge in racing. Okay, so we go back, and now it's 2 hours before the final. We're in the final. We're seated number one. And now how do you get to number one? How do you get there? So what I've learned in being on the team is that to be a winner, you know, you have to be consistent, you have to be persistent, and don't let distractions take your attention away from what you're doing. And one of those distractions can be weather. So I remember this one practice when we went out, I went to practice, and it was overcast, but much worse than what we're looking at today. And when we start to get in the ball, it starts pouring. I mean, it's pouring exclamation points all on my shoulders. And usually, you know, I'm going the house when it's raining, but the coach says load the boat. And so we have to go out there and practice. And after a while, I don't even, you know, notice it. And I kind of miss the rain when it goes away. So now we're headed out for the final. We paddle out to the starting line, and we have a few minutes because the other two boats have to get out there, and I'm nervous. Rob has switched me to the left side, thank God, but I'm still nervous. This is the final, right? And the sky is looking all angry, making faces at us, and I have to remember, focus, you know, get my attention in the boat, get my head in the boat. So I bring my eyes down, and I'm looking down the center of the boat, and I can see my teammates' shoulders, and I'm like, okay, and I'm looking down at the surface, and then, don't you know, I see that the surface of the lake starts to get holes in it, and it starts to rain, and it starts to rain on my head, and I think, I bet these other teams don't know how to paddle in the rain, but we do. We got this. And I'm telling you this story because we won. We got first place at Lake Orion and a gold medal. So I guess that's the moral of the story is, you know, to hang in there and be a winner. So thank you so much for listening to my story.
Thanks, Deidre. We have one more pop-up story storyteller. I'll remind you that we have two more pop-up story events coming up. And they're both on my postcard sitting at my table. Sunday, October 11th at the East Lansing Public Library. Loan and Borrow is the theme. Also, October 21st at the Reach Studio Art Center. The theme is Create and Destroy. Tonight it's been Hungry and Fed. Keep in mind that you can tweet your stories using the hashtag PopUpStories. So this is an ongoing series of events. Hashtag pop-up stories. The most memorable meal I ever had was when my dog jumped on my table and ate our Easter dinner. Every dog owner has been through that, right? Thank you all for that. My most memorable meal, Friendsgiving meal in my dorm at Alma College. My friends and I cooked everything, and it was pretty delicious, if I do say so myself. Our last storyteller here for the evening, Helen Nethaway Mindiola, has a story involving hungry and fed.
Hello, everybody. You can get endorphins from receiving. Look at it Christmas time, the children. But you can get more endorphins when you get older from giving. I get endorphins. It puts chills up and down my spine sometimes, the things that happen. And life becomes an adventure. I came today not to tell a story, but to find out what this is that's growing in my tomato ring in the backyard. I thought it was a pumpkin. The leaves are this big. Can you imagine? And now they've reached the house, and they're going up the backside of the house. So I feel like, I don't think it's a threat, but it kind of makes you laugh when you see it. They told me it's not a pumpkin. It's not a squash. I thought I can put it in the microwave. There's about 12 blossoms per day coming out of this. It's a gourd, which is nice because it's just there. It has taken over so much that there are tomato plants growing inside the ring. They're supposed to be outside the ring, but this is not something I planted. This is where I took fruit and vegetable leftovers and took them out to the compost. Comes from the compost. So I've got about 12 flowers a day coming out. Some animal is coming there and nipping off some of the flowers. I think it's a woodchuck. I don't know. So this is a whole thing in itself. I have many stories. I'm older than most of the people here. I don't know. I think so. But what I would like to center on is something that shows if you can do something, if you can start something and have some ideas of what you're going to end up with, it becomes fantastic. It's a ride. In Venezuela, where I lived for 26 years, out on the farm, there were people around the countryside, especially Colombians, who had limited income. And I wanted to do something for them so that they could have more food. I picked up the Miami Herald. They get the Miami Herald in Venezuela in English. And it told about the Japanese tomato ring. I have become the tomato lady from the Japanese tomato ring. They call me the tomato lady. Hey, can you tell me? And then they ask me these questions about tomatoes. In Venezuela, I started the Japanese tomato ring. And I ended up with tomatoes so big that I and a neighbor, we would go out to the farm was out in the countryside, and we would get tomatoes that were close to 3 kilos. 3 kilos is about 6 pounds. It's beginning to look like a small pumpkin. And it was so impressive that my husband, who had a coffee farm, he was impressed, and he took, I think it was 8 or 13 hectares. Hectares are something similar to an acre. And planted all the tomato plants that I had left over. Because it said, the first instructions are, pick out the 4 best plants and only 4. Well, how am I going to know which are the 4 best plants if it's a package of seeds? So I planted them all. I had tomatoes not coming out my ears, but pretty close. And then my husband was so impressed, because here we're coming in with these big tomatoes, and it was an experience. You have to do things like this to really experience experiences. And he took and planted all those tomatoes. He got about 8 tomatoes or 9 tomatoes per plant. And I'm getting this really result. This, I turned it over to the people on the farm, and they shared it with other people. And then that was how I got into the tomato, the Japanese tomato ring. Japanese tomato ring is not invented by a Japanese. It was invented by a mail carrier in South Dakota, if I remember correctly. And it involves putting 4 plants on the outside of a 15-foot circle and putting your compost on the inside. And you dig up that and really prepare it well. And then, like I put trenches in. I put trenches from the plants outside to the center of the ring. And then a dip in the ring. And my time is up, right? And so what happened was I grew close to 2,000 tomatoes because I was here in Lansing, and they had a case where the gas went up about 10 years ago, 8 years ago, and people were really suffering, and it was, what can I do for them? So I decided better to teach them how to fish than to give them the fish. So I put it out in my front yard, and my daughter said, Mom, would you do me a favor? Take that tomato ring out of the front yard. Do you know what it's doing to the real estate value? And I said, let's ask the governor, the mayor. He's walking by right now, Bernero. And Bernero said, sure, you can plant that in the front yard. My dad was from Italy. He had tomatoes in his front yard all the time. So my daughter sort of backed off. Then... But the tomato ring, that tomato ring, people think I lie because I have so many stories from life. But life is to live it, to get out there and live it and do things. And in this case, I had about 2,000 tomatoes, 800 from one tomatillo, which is not a true tomato. 800 tomatillos just coming off, falling off. I didn't know what to do with them. This was to make green sauce. But around 2,000 tomatoes off 4 plants. This is what I did here in Lansing. And then I put how you do it. You can go online and look for the Japanese tomato ring, and it will tell you how to do it. And since that time, my energy has been sort of decreased, so I don't. I've never done what I did at the beginning. But that first crop was unforgettable. And then I have pictures of 5 families in my front yard talking about their tomato ring, because it's your tomato ring. If you walk or ride a bicycle, you can take the tomatoes. And they would come and sit there and talk. They'd start out talking. They got to know neighbors a little bit more than, good morning, good morning. How are you? Fine, thank you. How are you? It became where you get to know your neighbors. And I still have people coming to me and asking me about the tomato ring. This year I have some tomatoes that are the beef eaters. But I planted it about a month ago or 2 months ago, way too late. But look it up and take the trip. Thank you.
Thanks, Helen. Appreciate it. And we thank all of you for coming to our first Pop-Up Stories event once again, Sunday, October 11th, East Lansing Public Library, 2 p.m., Loan and Borrow. October 21st, Reach Studio Art Center, Create and Destroy. Many thanks to Katie Wittenauer and Dean Steve Esquith of the MSU Residential College of Arts and Humanities for joining forces with WKAR's Current State. And a big thank you to Mike Scorey as well. Thank you, April. April Van Buren made this happen from Current State. We'll see you at one of our further events. Thank you.